Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Every day here at the Open House Studios, we consider ourselves to be among the most fortunate in that we're given the chance to hear from people whose lives and experiences defy hyperbole. Here's another one of those stories. Christine Durham was a much-loved teacher at a very prominent school. Her kids were on the cusp of leaving home, and she and her husband of 25 years, Ted, were keen to explore the next chapters of their life together. Then Christine was critically injured in a freak accident that left her struggling to form words and perform the most basic of life's functions. Her recovery since has seen her return to teaching, write a number of great books, and attain a doctorate in understanding acquired brain injuries, like Christine's. Dr. Christine Durham, you're most welcome to Open House. Thank you for joining us. Let's begin with your life days before that accident was nearly to take your life. Everything was just about perfect, wasn't it?
22 years ago, I was totally on top of the world. A week before I had this horrific car accident, I was literally on top of the world in Mexico.
Yeah.
I'd been speaking at an International Philosophy for Children conference and had a wonderful time there. And my husband and I went down to Uxmal, and there was this perfect night, and we were swimming in this teardrop-shaped pool, and the sun set and the water turned pink and a thousand swallows flitted down to drink. And I thought, oh, isn't life wonderful? Our four kids are nearly grown up. We're having adventures at last. Now it's time for me. I'll write my book and get people thinking. And yes, and then we got home and I had this horrific accident.
That accident, that day, how vivid is your memory of it? Or is it just a piecemeal recollection of those around you?
I had an absolutely vivid memory because getting back to school, having been away for some time in Mexico, I was extra pleased to see my students. I'd finished my reports, I locked my door of my classroom, got into my car with the reports on the back seat, driving calmly into Melbourne Uni where I was doing my Master's in Education, and I heard this bang and then everything was black. And this gentleman had flown out a side street, bashed the back passenger side of my car, which spun my car around and into a pole. Quite a few teachers from school just surpassed the car and everyone thought I was dead, and no one could believe that I'd survived. So, I was pretty, really bad. And unfortunately, the gentleman who hit my car went off to get a quote to have his car fixed. But a lovely guy going in the opposite direction stopped and got the seatbelt off from around my neck, which was choking me. So I had like a stroke as well as brain injury and smashed up. And I have stayed friendly with that lovely man who helped.
What a remarkable presence in your life.
Yes, he's like my guardian angel. He said he got home and had a stiff drink and said to his wife, well, I was with this lady, but she's not going to make it. So I had fractures to more than half my ribs, multiple fractures, a fractured skull, a fractured clavicle. I had two fingers on my right hand that worked eventually once I got them working, but the rest of me was pretty crooked. My left side was pretty well paralysed. My hand was like a ball, and I used to pull out the fingers and sit on them, and now it's a really good hand now. It's very handy. But the worst thing, I think, was the agony, but coming to and eventually opening my eyes, and everyone coming out of the fog had two heads. And I couldn't believe it. It just seemed so remarkable. And, of course, I had no words to say, why have you got two heads?
You're trapped within your mind, aren't you?
Totally. And the most remarkable thing happened in intensive care. I had a near-death experience. I got pneumonia and I had a deflated lung and things. I had this unbelievable epiphany that the most important thing we own are our own thoughts. And from that, even though I'm unconscious, came the conclusion, it's up to me to discover the secret of thinking.
Wow.
So I had this sort of task set to me even when I was unconscious.
You start to communicate, not with words, but by using what was left of your tongue after you bit it in the car accident.
Yes, I'd bitten half my tongue off for having an epileptic fit, and I still had some sort of, I suppose it's gut reaction, so I could stick it out all the time and point to it, try to point to it to show it was sore. And eventually I got through to them that I was seeing two, and they put a patch over one eye, and that was great.
You speak about being permanently immersed in a cloud of pain.
Yes. It was exactly the same as if I was lying on a bed of red hot nails, and there was nothing I could do. Of course, I still couldn't move my arms very much to feed myself, although I was told I had to learn to be independent. They gave me a rope with knots in it. And if I wanted to try and sit up, which was beyond belief the pain, I had to grab the rope with the knot at the top and then gradually pull myself up. So it was pretty ghastly. And also they had to inflate my lung, which was traumatic for my family. I'd be just screaming in agony. And in the end, I managed to say, look, I'm not going to do this again. I'll jump out the window rather than do this. And to my surprise, the physio looked at me and said, oh, that's all right. If you can walk, instead, he said, anyway, I've never seen anyone with as many breaks in their ribs as you have.
Goodness.
So I had to try and fight for what I needed.
Christine, what do you understand about the damage to your brain in this week in general ward? Had people managed to get through to you that there are issues with your brain at this point?
No. I knew nothing. I just thought I'd gone mad. And I did know that if you were mad, they locked you up.
So you tried to conceal it?
So I tried to sort of pretend I knew what was happening. I didn't have a clue.
Goodness, you must have been so confused.
Totally bewildered. I was completely, you know, it was as though I'd just gone to this unimaginable place that we didn't know existed.
After 7 weeks of hiding and perhaps losing the battle on occasion to conceal your madness, in quotation marks, you go home and you find sympathy from a remarkable individual, somebody that understands your pain.
My dog. So it was quite remarkable. I obviously left hospital far too early. And the doctors kept saying, you must go to a rehab hospital. And in my mind, the people who went to rehab were soldiers. So I thought, well, the doctors all must be mad because I'm not a soldier. They must think I'm a soldier. So I refused to go to rehab. And I thought, if I get home, I'll find me. But me wasn't at home either because I didn't know where the tap was. But I did know the dog, and the dog instantly sensed my pain. And he didn't leave my side for months. Day and night he sat by me.
What a phenomenal lesson in acquired brain injury.
Yes, and since I've gone on and done a PhD, quite a few of the people I spoke to, they said they would have killed themselves but for their animals.
Goodness.
So animals are not judgmental, and they give us all this unconditional love. And when you're feeling really ashamed because you're not a proper person anymore, it's very safe.
You speak of the shame of not being a proper person. How did that shame amplify when you were back in what you hoped was going to be the return of the old Christine? Talk to me about the challenges in your place.
The challenges were quite horrific because I didn't know my name, and I really didn't know much of what was going on, and friends would call in and bring casseroles and flowers, and I felt really ashamed that I wasn't a proper person because I didn't feel grateful enough. I don't think I had many emotions apart from just shame, and I knew I was different, and I knew I must be an idiot because I couldn't remember where the drawer was, or I couldn't remember where the tap was. So you might have to be stupid when you can't dress yourself. And what really got me as far as shame was, my daughter would help me get dressed, and if I had a tracksuit and she'd do up a zip, I didn't feel as bad as if I had something to button because I couldn't do up my buttons.
Goodness.
And I knew at school little preppies couldn't do up zips, and it was okay to help them, and they were proper people. But, you know, doing up, I just thought, if I can do up my buttons, I'll be a proper person again. I was worse than a child. But the good thing about this was being like a child. All my dad, I had a very wise dad, I had the best dad in the whole world, and he'd take me for thinking walks from the time I was about 3 or 4, and he'd discuss chess or politics with me and stuff I didn't understand. But that little fire inside me, a fire of hope and the fire that I could think things through for myself, so that part of being a child was good. And dad's sayings, he was a great fisherman, he'd say, chick, if you've got problems, tip all the worms out of the can. And I used to think, but my problems are much more like a bag of snakes. I kept trying to analyse these problems that I had.
Which is an indication that, in part, you're still a fully rounded adult if you are judging yourself as being unable to act like one.
Yes. So there's this dichotomy of, on one hand, you're really, really dumb, And, you know, I'd think I might go and pick some flowers in the garden. I'd pick an armful that wouldn't fit in the vase. So I had no idea of some things or numbers. But on an intellectual level, I was thinking or problem solving at a really high level. And I found this with the people I've been interviewing with my PhD, that you might, you know, they mightn't walk very well and they mightn't talk very well, but get to let them have the opportunity. And the wisdom just knocked me off my feet.
Talk about some of the other challenges. What other gaps in your childhood to adulthood were you re-grappling with? How were you with, for instance, running a bath or other what would have been considered regular everyday events?
I couldn't do it. And even when my daughter turned on the shower and I got in the shower, I'd stand there and think of if I had wet hair, if I just washed my hair, am I going to wash my hair? How long have I been in the shower? It feels like several years, but maybe so I didn't understand anything. I couldn't walk, so I used our bedroom's downstairs. So to get up in the morning, I'd actually crawl up the stairs till my body got working again. So nighttime was horrific with this dragon of pain that would overwhelm me. But then again, that was good because I used to have to wake my husband and say to pick me up. He'd pull me up on a sheepskin and give me painkillers. And one night couldn't wake him. In the end, I was kicking him and saying, please wake me up, I'm in agony.
Goodness.
And he sort of mumbled, I'm just taking a sleeping pill, I need some sleep. And that made me solve some more problems. So I worked out that if I got on the other side of the bed, I could kick on the wall and pull on the sheet and the blanket and pull myself upright. So the challenges of being a kid and understanding you can overcome them.
Christine, this must have been taking a tremendous toll on your marriage.
It was horrific. And also, you know, even getting a taxi driver to take me when eventually I did little bits of rehab, they'd say, oh, this breaks up all marriages. But no, ours was good, although my shame was really awful. And I was positive because I wasn't the person he'd married. And I was this disgusting person who always had the dinner spilt down the front because I couldn't eat properly and I could only poke food into my mouth with my hands and then I couldn't find my mouth and I couldn't talk properly. I was really, really, I thought I was loathsome. And, you know, for 2 years I felt he was just pretending to love me. And it was one day we were in the garden and I was picking some honesty plant. Do you know honesty?
Yeah, absolutely.
And that honesty spoke to me and said to me, for heaven's sake, be honest with him. And so I said to him, darling, you don't really love me. And he said, what do you mean? And he said, of course I do. And you know what? I'd been, just how I wanted to do up my buttons to be a proper person. In my mind, I became fixated in, if he really loved me, he'd give me a pat. Because all I wanted was a pat from him. I got a pat from the dog, but I really needed him to just give me a pat. And so I could say to him, darling, you don't really love me because you've never given me a pat. And it was the most amazing thing, this bit of honesty, because it was the first time we were really honest with ourselves. And he could express that to his mind as an engineer and very left hemisphere dominant, he didn't think a pat would make me better. And he thought another doctor or another painkiller would. So it allowed us to start to discuss things because we were both sweeping a lot of things under the mat and pretending things were okay when they weren't.
What a powerful moment. And then, Christine, a local GP, after years of struggling, dropped into your life and opened a door for you, didn't he?
I was a totally crushed person. Body, soul, every part of me. I couldn't understand normal everyday things. And our lovely GP visited me at home and he was very much a fan of racing car drivers. And he explained how they often got smashed up but they got back in the race of life. And he said something incredibly wise and empowering. He said it was up to me whether I got back in the car of life and got on with the race, or he quite understood if I just wanted to stay home for the rest of my life. So that was the only bit of advice like that I got from the 20 or 30 specialists I saw. Most of them took all my hope away, but he gave me that little bit of hope. And of course, the most important thing to get better again and to recapture yourself and to put the effort in is having some hope.
Yeah. So you grasp on the smallest sliver of a better tomorrow.
Yes. Well, I think probably crazy thing of when I realised I could get myself up in bed. That was the first bit of success I'd had for months. So there's nothing like success to breed success, is there? And from that time I thought, well, yes, there is something I can start to do. And that was very, very valuable. And then I decided I wanted to go back to uni, which was mad.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't even understand what people were saying. But my husband drove me in and he took me to the lecture theatre and he sat me down and he put a pencil in my hand and he put a book beside me. And the lecture went on and I didn't understand any words. It was as though they were talking in Swahili or something.
Goodness.
But gradually, week by week by week, I started to see little tiny bits of sense. Some of it made sense and I could understand it.
So at this point, you are literally retraining your brain.
Retraining it. And of course, I was a total idiot and a slow learner, but I wanted to get back to school because I wasn't at home and I wasn't at uni where I'd been doing this master's in education. So I thought, well, maybe Chris is at school. So I insisted on going back to school, and fortunately it was worked out that I'd help in the library where I wept into my eye patch, and it was very painful because the kids all wanted to hug me and I had all these broken bones, and I'd come home and have a hot shower because my body didn't control temperature and I'd be so cold, and then I'd fall into an exhausted sleep. But then I started taking philosophy and thinking sessions with them. And that was an incredible way of kick-starting. The kids kick-started me.
Wow. Isn't life a rich circle in that regard?
It was wonderful, absolutely amazing. And, of course, I couldn't read, so I used to think of, well, how can I get the kids to look at something curious? So I'd use a can of baked beans, and I'd go into the class, and we all sat round a big round table, and I'd put the can of baked beans on the table and say, the lesson's in the can. And, of course, I had their curiosity, which, if you've got kids' curiosity, wonderful things happen.
Mm.
And I'd just say to them, what story has beans in it? And they might say, Jack and the Beanstalk. And I'd say, I was just wondering, is Jack good or bad? Now, I nearly cry when I say this. Preps, five-year-old kids. First kid said, Jack was good because he killed the giant. And the next child said, does that mean it's good to kill bad people? And the next child said, how do we know who's good or bad?
Wow.
So I had kids thinking like this.
Man.
One day we played Simon Says, and because we were locked out of the classroom, it was raining and we were all wet as shags. So when we got into class, I thought, well, I can't do anything about getting on with what I'm going to do. So I said, give me some advice for life that would also be advice to someone playing Simon Says for the first time. And they come out with, well, you know, you have to think very hard, you have to think for yourself and not copy other people and all this sort of thing. So it's really, really amazing how you can get kids to think. And they actually had 20 pieces of advice for life from Simon Says.
And in this process, are you continuing your own re-education about life using prep school students?
Yes, they taught me about life. They taught me about kindness. They taught me about so many things. They'd take the pen out. I started to think, well, I better do something to show the boss on. We're actually having good discussions. And I tried to take notes, and I'd get a big bit of butcher's paper and try and write on it, but my hand didn't work very well, and I couldn't spell for nuts. And the children would come up to me and take the pen out of my hand and say, Mrs. D, you know you can't spell. Let us do it for you. And from that, I wrote another book called Chasing Ideas, and Edward de Bono did the blurb for it. So it's really funny to think someone who couldn't think managed to learn to think again.
You went on to do your PhD, and that in itself is a monumental return. And how much of the old Christine is back as you begin your PhD, or is she back at all, even today?
I'm a different Christine. I wrote a book about a brain injury, my experience of brain injury, which, lo and behold, Penguin published. And I sort of gave it to a literary agent, and within a week, Penguin had signed me on. And that was called Doing Up Buttons. And you've got to guess why, because I had to learn to do them up. But that has now been reprinted by Jane Curry Publishing as Unlocking My Brain Through the Labyrinth of Acquired Brain Injury. And that has all my PhD findings as well as buttons in it. But I from when buttons came out, lots of people contacted me to help them and to speak to them. And I was speaking to some disability liaison officers, and just over coffees, three of the individuals said, you should do a PhD. So I thought, well, let's have a go. But, of course, you know, I wanted to interview 30 people with brain injury, and I can't count, so I accidentally interviewed 36 people, but I also interviewed carers and professionals to find out what their experience was with brain injury was.
And you refer to the injury as the cage.
Yes. So from my experience of using baked beans and playing Simon Says at school, I found some ways into people's heads. So I had a very beautiful bird cage, fancy bird cage, and it sat in my study. I used to have birds in it, which were fantail doves, and they'd be helpful if I went on TV to talk about my book, because fantail doves aren't like proper birds. They can't fly or walk properly, and I wasn't like a proper person. But this cage, I thought, that can be the cage of brain injury. And I stuck my walking stick into the cage, and on my walking stick I hung what I called talkabout cards of all the difficulties we can have that can put us in the cage. And that could be from can't talk properly, can't see, you know, all the difficulties, myriads. But the thing that locks us in the cage is we feel sad, mad and bad. And you know, in my cage I had a crushed soft drink can. I had a lot of symbols in this. Mm. This big, big thing which we took around to all the interviews. And, do you know, so many people wanted me to unlock the cage. They took out that crushed solo drink can and said, that's my life. Yes. But beside that, I had a big wooden pole with a flying pig. I made fly wire wings for a little wooden pig. And that had all the keys that can get us out of the cage. And I use this to interview people and allow them to tell their story.
Christine, from one who's been inside the cage, and I suspect still struggles with it every now and again in your own life,
oh, yes,
even today.
I can't understand time and maths and all sorts of things, yes.
What do those of us who are outside the cage but love those that are in it need to understand about that life? How can we respond to people with an acquired brain injury? And even if not now, when we come across somebody who's incurred one of these injuries, what do we need to do to start?
Well, first of all, we need to start by thinking they're not to blame. I know brain injury, there's some shade of darkness over brain injury. You must have been doing something stupid, or you might be to blame. Also, I don't think people realise that brain injury damages much more than our brains and our body and our beliefs. It also damages our hope and our honour and our trust and our safety and our security. So if you realise someone with brain injury is feeling all those things, treating them with kindness and understanding and showing them you understand a bit about brain injury is so important, because 1 in 45 in our society has brain injury, and that's meant to be just the tip of the iceberg.
1 in 45?
1 in 45, and we all try and hide it, because nobody wants to be different. So it's quite frightening to think there's much more than 1 in 45. And of course, in one way, the physical or the problems with cognition might be different, but how people feel sad, mad and bad and ashamed and afraid and isolated is the same. And so there's a lot that the general public can do just to be more caring and understanding, because it's quite a horrible thing when people really know nothing about brain injury or think if you've got brain injury you must be sort of stupid, because we mightn't be able to talk very well, but we might have some really good ideas.
I was inspired by this quote. There's a lot of wisdom in this room full of people with ABI. A lot of experiences. When you look back over what has been a colourful life to date, without in any way forecasting what is tomorrow, have you ever wished that you didn't have that accident that day?
Oh, that's a very hard question. And I suppose the best way to answer it is sometimes you learn from other people, and several of the participants in my PhD study quite remarkably all said the same thing, that brain injury was both the best and the worst thing that had happened to them in their life. And they now really appreciate being alive. They're aware of their strengths and weaknesses, and they feel wise. So I think I must agree with all those people that I now feel wise because of my brain injury, because I've had to relearn, that I've had the honour of being a child twice.
Christine, it's been an unmitigated delight. Thank you for sharing the time with us on Open House.
It's been wonderful to talk to you.
You'll find Dr. Christine Durham's book, Unlocking My Brain Through the Labyrinth of Acquired Brain Injury, at your nearest favourite bookstore or online right now.